All right, so we're going to learn about prostatitis, epididymitis, and orchitis today with a focus on attestable material because these are topics that are not well studied. So there's not a lot of testable material. I don't have any disclosures. So just to remind you which body part we are talking about, we're going to be talking about the epididymis, which sits posterior to the testicle. We're talking about prostate, which is here, and we're going to be talking about orchitis, which would be the testicle itself. And all of these can become infected, and I think what's going to infect them can be different. So let's start with a case. We have a 72-year-old man who came to the emergency room with fever, urinary retention. He did not have a urine culture sent, but he was sent home with a transurethral catheter and on ciprofloxacin. This is my actual patient. Later, he came to the ID clinic 1 month later and said, "Hey, when is someone going to take this catheter out? It's really been bothering me." He had a TEP of 102.5, which he hadn't really noticed, caused a vertebral angle tenderness present, and we admitted him and started on ciprofloxacin. This was some time ago. There was less resistance among organisms to ciprofloxacin. So we turned out to be pretty lucky with our choice because his blood cultures grew serratia marcescens sensitive to cipro. And his urine cultures grew serratia marcescens and Klebsiella, both sensitive to cipro. Unfortunately, on hospital day two, he's still febrile to 102.3, so really not better much. And he says, "You know, it's hurting in my right testicle. It's swollen." He says, "You know, now that I think about it, I think I've had this for like the last 7 days, but it's bothering me more now." So, given his fevers on 2 days of ciprofloxacin and the new awareness of the right testicular pain and swelling, and your next step is to, and you do have the culture results at this point, you know what things are sensitive to. You can add vancomycin to cover for enterococci. B, you could order a scrotal ultrasound. C, you could add doxycycline in case you missed a sexually transmitted infection. Or D, you could consult urology emergently for testicular torsion. Give you a moment to answer. Also, the reason there's a picture of a picket fence is to remind you that with the urological infections such as pyelonephritis or prostatitis, epididymitis, it's frequently a picket fence fever that takes 72 hours to really go down. Okay, so let's see what we're going to do. Well, no, we're not going to add to cover enterococci. It's a good thought if you don't know what the organism is because chronic bacterial prostatitis often, well, he doesn't have chronic, but enterococci tend to be involved with that. But in this case, we already know the causative organisms. They're covered by ciprofloxacin. So it's not an antibiotic problem. Yes, we want a scrotal ultrasound because let's see what's going on with the right testicle. In terms of adding doxycycline to cover sexually transmitted infections, great idea in some patients, but in this patient, he did have an indwelling catheter for the last month, so it's a little unlikely that he has a new sexually transmitted infection. And we also know for sure that he has bacteremia from a urinary source and persistent fever in 48 hours is normal for pyelonephritis. And if you're consulting urology for testicular torsion, this is really not a leading concern. I'll go over the symptoms of that. But also, if he had torsion for 48 hours, you are too late. So yes, let's do a scrotal ultrasound and see what's going on in his right testicle. To remind you again of the anatomy, so this is the front of the patient. Imagine the patient is standing up and facing forward. This is the front. So the epididymis is on the back of the testicle. So that's where you would see swelling, posterior testicle with epididymitis. Now, the problem is, I think most people don't get a lot of opportunities to examine the testicles. And if the patient is lying down in bed, it's really hard to see the back of the scrotum and the back of the testicles. So you can lie the patient on their side, have them pull their knees up, and voila, you can see the posterior aspect of the testicles with that approach. So how does epididymitis present? Testicular pain, swelling tenderness, scrotal erythema, and fever. You can have some dysuria, urinary irritative symptoms because the bacteria get there from the bladder and they backwash into the epididymis. Urethral discharge, you can have a hydrocele, that's actually very common, that a lot of edema ends up in the scrotum. And if the testicles also become inflamed, it progresses to epididymo or orchitis. And it's typically epididymitis is a gradual onset like this with this patient. He's like, "Yeah, it's been bothering me for 7 days. It's really bothering me more now." If it's sudden, again, think about testicular torsion. and the cremasteric reflex is preserved in epididymitis and not so much in torsion. That's if you stroke the inner thigh, the scrotum contracts on that side. So what are the risk factors for getting epididymitis? You know, urinary outlet obstruction, like our patient had with a catheter that was placed. So he had urinary tract instrumentation. Prostate biopsy could be a risk. Sometimes with immunosuppression, it's a risk factor. Insertive anal intercourse and also sexually transmitted infections are pretty common in epididymitis. But anything that facilitates bacteria flowing backwards and ending up in the epididymis are risk factors. So what can cause epididymitis? This is probably a little misleading because it's saying under 35, you want to focus on sexually transmitted. I work at a VA hospital. I have plenty of patients in their 80s that get sexually transmitted infections. So I think you need to consider Neisseria, chlamydia at all ages. And then you also think of for epididymitis of the enteric flora that can spread from the urine, E. coli, Klebsiella, Proteus, Pseudomonas, and enterococci, which is a known urinary pathogen. And then it's, you know, you're the ID doctor, so they're going to call you when it's really an atypical organism that they find. The TB could get there, Brucella, Nocardia, Blasto, a lot of different things can get into the epididymis. So how do you work it up? Physical exam. The cremasteric reflex should be intact. The testes should be in the normal location, not high and turned sideways. You don't want to see a draining sinus. You can do a gram stain of urethral secretions. This was a gram stain of urethral discharge that shows Neisseria gonorrhea. You need nucleic acid amplification test of urine. When they're, you know, when febrile, consider blood cultures because sometimes you retrieve the causative pathogen that way, and maybe the urine culture doesn't get sent initially until they've had antibiotics. So sometimes your blood cultures are what rescues you with knowing what the organism is. But if you see rapidly progressing soft tissue involvement, we're out of the zone of epididymitis. You need to consider necrotizing fasciitis. And if it doesn't improve in 40 to 72 hours, definitely do a scrotal ultrasound. Is there an abscess there? Is there an abscess in the testicle? And obviously call urology at any point if there's concern for torsion. How do you differentiate epididymitis from torsion? I think testicular torsion is acute onset with a high-riding testicle that is transversely oriented. That's the main thing to remember on that. All right, so how do you treat it? If you think what's going on is your patient most likely has a sexually transmitted infection based on their history, then you can do ceftriaxone and doxycycline. However, if you don't know, for example, if your patient is practicing insertive anal sex, that's a risk factor for having enteric organisms in the epididymis. So you could go with ceftriaxone for the Neisseria and levofloxacin or another fluoroquinolone to cover both chlamydia and the enteric flora, perhaps a little more broadly than you would get with doxycycline. On the other hand, if it's someone like our patient who they've had a catheter in their penis, we're pretty sure they were not having inserted intercourse during that period of time, no prior sexually transmitted infections. So we're thinking it's enteric gram-negative organisms. So levofloxacin or cipro is good. Trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, if you think the organism might be sensitive, are good options. And for all, I think it's important to remember that you do want pain relief. It's a very sensitive area of the body, and elevation can help, and ice packs help, because otherwise a whole bunch of edema rushes to the testicle, and the patient gets a really swollen scrotum. So you want to give them the elevation and the cold packs. All right, and management of complications. We talked about medical management and the complications, which you would need to consult urology, would be testicular infarction, scrotal abscess, and epididymo. Orchitis. So that's why we wanted to do an ultrasound on our patient at this point, see if there's anything else deeper that we needed to worry about. There wasn't. He just had epididymitis and he defervesced by day 3. Okay, so case 2. I think we mentioned epididymo orchitis. So let's talk about a case of that. So we have a 63-year-old man who's living in Houston, homeless, and he presented with a gradually enlarging painful right testicle over the past 4 months. It's afebrile, he has thickened right throatal skin, you don't see any fistula, got a high white count, negative HAV, negative beta HCG, so less concern for tumor, but still possible. CT shows uneven enhancement of the right testis, also the epididymis, but here's the kicker. The left epididymis was also enlarged with diffuse enhancement. So out of these options, which would you not do next? A TB spot or QuantiFERON gold? B, a urine culture for AFB, C, a testicular biopsy, and D, a urine PCR for TB. Keep in mind, both epididymi are involved, and the testicle is involved. This is not likely to be a tumor, but you still don't get much value out of a biopsy. This is probably a chronic infection, such as TB or a fungal infection, but a testicular biopsy would be contraindicated in case there were a germ cell tumor, but also it's insensitive and can be false negative in these infections. Unless it hits exactly the right spot, you don't get a lot of mycobacteria in there, and so you can do a biopsy, cause the patient to have a painful procedure, and not find what you need. So you wouldn't go with biopsy, you go with other workup for chronic infectious causes. And remember I mentioned TB is pretty common as chronic cause, also fungal and some of the longer acting bacteria. So let's talk briefly about tuberculosis epididymo or chitis. It usually starts from the epididymis and can spread hematogenously or continuously or directly from sexual contact, presents as a painful scrotal mass, and is often bilateral. TB testing tends to be positive, and you can work it up through the AFP stain culture PCR of urine. You can also try to get prostatic secretions, which I'm going to talk about later, but you can do that. You don't want to do any fine needle biopsy if there's concern for germ cell tumor, and you definitely want to treat it because the next thing that happens is you get a fistula or an abscess or infertility. All right, so we had the good fortune to write a review on acute and chronic bacterial prostatitis, which is in Clinical Infectious Diseases. I'm going to present the figures from that here because I think they really introduce our prostatitis section beautifully and give a good summary. So on the left, we're going to be talking about acute bacterial prostatitis. On the right, we're going to be talking about chronic. So who do you consider this in? In all patients with prostates. Remember, gender doesn't necessarily track with the presence or absence of a prostate. So if the patient has a prostate, they can have prostatitis. So if they have acute UTI symptoms, pelvic pain, and systemic signs of infection, we don't think about prostatitis often enough, and we should more often. For acute, it's sudden onset. They're often quite sick. Pelvic pain is pretty common, but not necessarily there. To diagnose it, you want to do a gentle digital rectal exam. Believe it or not, you could do this, and you should do it if you think there might be acute prostatitis. You don't mash hard. You're not trying to cause sepsis or bacteremia, but you need to see if there's any tenderness there. Urinalysis, urine culture, inflammatory markers, treatment to greater than or equal to 2 weeks and antibiotics, and watch out for development of prosthetic abscesses. So if it's chronic bacterial prostatitis you're thinking about, again, considering patients with prostates who have recurrent UTIs with the same pathogen with chronic pelvic pain. It's gradual onset, rare systemic signs, recurrent pelvic discomfort is common. To diagnose, we're going to talk about this, but I'm recommending the two-glass test. You have the patient urinate, you rub the prostate, and then they urinate again, and you compare the specimens in terms of white count and bacterial counts. Treatment is about 4 to 6 weeks of antibiotics. In refractory cases, may need surgical intervention, but that's pretty rare, but there's also chronic pelvic pain syndrome. Things to think about, risk factors are any structural abnormalities of the genital urinary tract, having had a transrectal prostate biopsy. Remember, we're now seeing more transperineal prostate biopsy, which is not as big of a risk factor for infection. Diabetes, indwelling catheter. And again, I'm going to emphasize the value of the digital rectal exam in prostatitis. We just don't think about prostatitis enough. It's interesting. In the U.S., a febrile man with urinary symptoms, we almost always call it pyelonephritis. In Europe, unless there's something specifically seen on CAT scan that localizes to the kidneys, they would call that prostatitis. So we talked about the digital rectal examination, the 2 to 4 glass test. And again, don't do prosthetic massage. You're not in there trying to provoke sepsis. You're just seeing if it's tender, and you don't do it with patients with neutropenia. Why is it so hard to get antibodies in the prostate? Well, here's a pretty good picture. It's a lot of glands, a lot of deep branching ducts, and there's all sorts of capillaries that don't have, you know, penetration of them. So fluoroquinolones penetrate really well because they're lipid-soluble. Beta-lactams, poor penetration, nitrofurantoin doesn't get there at all. NIH has 4 prostate consensus categories. We are only concerning ourselves with the top 2. Let me show you that in a table. So we're concerned with acute and chronic bacterial prostatitis, not chronic pelvic pain, and not asymptomatic inflammatory prostatitis. And the reason is these are the 2 that are infectious and have actual bacteria. So case three is a 69-year-old man who presents with pain in the lower abdomen, rectum, and perineum for the past 48 hours. He has chills, nausea, and urinary urgency, frequency, and dysuria. You did a gentle digital rectal exam, and you find a painful and swollen prostate. To make things worse, he hasn't been able to urinate for the past 10 hours. So, management should include A, nitrofurantoin, B, urology consultation for catheterization, C, culture of expressed prostatic secretions, and D, PSA levels. Okay, you all have it figured out already. Okay, nitrofurantoin doesn't get into the prostate. Also, don't be fooled. This is not pyelonephritis. This man has prostatitis. It hurts in his prostate. He's got lower abdominal pelvic pain. Urology consultation is going to be needed here. Even if they are don't want to come initially, you don't want to be putting a Foley right past an inflamed prostate. That requires special help. So they sometimes do a suprapubic, or they do the transurethral placed with care. You don't want to be massaging the prostate to get expressed prostatic secretions in this case. That can cause bacteremia. And PSA is going to be pretty high because the prostate's inflamed, but it's not going to be specific enough to help you here. So acute bacterial prostatitis presents with an acutely ill patient. Prostatic tenderness is a key distinguishing feature, so that requires examination. Fever, chills, and they call it irritative urinary symptoms, but in men, that could just sometimes be complete urinary retention. They just can't urinate because of the bladder spasms and urethral spasms. Lower abdominal pain, voiding difficulties, and the pathogenesis, it often spreads from infection in the bladder. It can spread from a prostate biopsy transrectally performed or even hematogenously. And the same risk factors as everything else. Catheters, you know, urinary stasis, urinary instrumentation. So what causes it? In acute, most of it is going to be your gram-negative bacteria. There are some caused by staph strep and enterococci. HIV has a slightly higher association with salmonella, but that is extremely rare. And also based on some HIV studies before we had a good treatment for HIV, there could occasionally be a question on traveler to Southeast Asia in the context of systemic illness overall. They might also have burkholderia in the prostate. Then you can get sexually transmitted infections there. Chronic infections is really the same bacterial organisms as acute prostatitis, except we hope to publish this soon, but enterococci are a bit more common in the chronic prostatitis than in the acute. You can also have mycobacteria. Just about any fungus could go hang out in the prostate. Brucella can be there too. So all the fun stuff that you love to put together, the pieces of diagnose and treat, yes, it can be hanging out in the prostate. So how do you work it up? Physical exam, you're looking for a painful prostate, urinalysis, urine culture, consider blood cultures again, because, you know, a lot of times the blood cultures are drawn promptly, but the urine culture isn't drawn for a while because the patient's not urinating and the antibiotics have already been started. So then you lose the chance to figure out what the organism is. If someone doesn't get better within your 48 to 72 hours with the fever going down, still spiking like that picket fence, but heading down, you want to do a prostate ultrasound or a CAT scan or an MRI just to check for an abscess. If they can't void initially, it's worth a call to urology to see if they want to help with a catheter placement. So what are you going to treat it with? We talked about it's diverse causes, but if the acute prostatitis is critically ill, you're going to kind of assume it's one of the Enterobacterales and start with cephalosporin. Then you can go with cefepime, even if you're worried about Pseudomonas. Piperacillin, carbapenems, plus minus an aminoglycoside, depending on if the patient has had resistant organisms before, depending on what you need to cover. How long to treat? No good trials of duration, so you're not going to get asked on that. But more than the 7 days we recommend for complicated UTI now. It's probably 2 to 4 weeks for prostatitis. Harder to get the antibiotics in there. The oral options, fluoroquinolones, have the best documented prostate penetration. Also, trimethoprim sulfa methoxazole. Probably get the tetracyclines in there, the macrolides and fosfomycin as well. For chronic prostatitis, this will not be an exam question because we do not know how long to treat, but durations of 4 weeks or more are recommended. All right, our next case. So we have a 72-year-old man with pain in the perineum, the tip of the penis, and the scrotum. It's been bothering him for 3 months. About a week ago, he had lower back pain, but that pain has subsided. He's had 2 episodes of UTI with, you know, actual dysuria in the past 6 months. You do a physical exam. His prostate is boggy and tender, not amazingly tender, but slightly tender. What's the most common cause of a chronic form of this condition? A is herpes, B is chlamydia, C is E. coli, and D is candida. We're talking about chronic prostate pain, broad, boggy prostate, recurrent UTIs. Yes, it's going to be E. coli. The most likely cause of chronic prostatitis, especially given its history of recurrent UTIs, is going to be E. coli or another gram negative. All these other organisms, herpes doesn't really cause prostatitis, but, you know, candida is also very rare. So how are you going to diagnose it? They're not acutely ill, commonly have recurrent UTI with the same organism. How are you going to differentiate that from they just have recurrent UTI with the same organism because they have a big prostate and thus they retain urine and the same organism gets in there from the stool? Well, you're probably going to need to do the two glass test. Now, don't everybody all groan at once. You really can do this. So the patient urinates. You tell them not to empty the bladder completely. You do a prostate massage, which is basically a digital rectal exam, where you rub to the left of the side of the prostate and then to the right side of the prostate, each for about 30 seconds. And then you ask the patient to finish avoiding. And you're looking for tenfold higher counts of bacteria and white blood cells between the pre-sample and the post-sample. The four glass test is too complicated, and I think that is rarely performed even by urologists. It gets a lot of press, but two glass test is more practical. Okay, so case number five, 58-year-old man presents with fever and shaking chills the day after he had transrectal prostate biopsy. Prior to the biopsy, he'd received oral ciprofloxacin. He had a UTI 3 months ago, and he was treated with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole for that. In the emergency department, his temp is 101.5. He has Rigor's. He has rectal pain. He's having trouble voiding. His creatinine is normal. Blood and urine culture is sent. Which of the following antibiotics will be the best empiric choice? This is your acute prostatitis after a biopsy. So A is amikacin. B is fosfomycin. C is ciprofloxacin. And D is trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. So we're not going to use cipro because you just got that, so the organism is probably resistant. We're not going to use trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole because he just got exposed to that within the prior 3 months, and we think he's probably bacteremic given how sick he is. Same problem with fosfomycin. It's not reliable in the bloodstream. So you've got, you know, amikacin is a reasonable choice with normal renal function to start, but also you could use a carbapenem. You can use a third-generation cephalosporin. You know, but this is one of the cases where short-term, you know, aminoglycoside use could work while you're waiting for cultures. So antibiotic prophylaxis for transrectal prostate biopsy is strongly recommended. Transperineal biopsy, it's controversial. You won't be tested on it, but probably don't need antibiotics. There's no one best choice. You're not going to be tested on the best choice because there is no one best choice, but you might be asked about how to give it. It's one dose, 1 hour prior to the procedure. You don't need to have people on antibiotics for 3 days prior to a transrectal prostate biopsy. And you're just trying to prevent the bacteremia and the organisms from getting into the prostate during the procedure. There's no benefit for enemas, and infection after the biopsy is almost always caused by fluoroquinolone-resistant E. coli if fluoroquinolones were used for the prophylactic agent. Case number six, we have a 55-year-old man with HIV with a CD4 of 32 who's referred to urology because he's having trouble voiding. Prostate exam showed asymmetrical enlargement. Urinalysis and urine culture were not exciting, and ultrasound showed bilateral nodules consistent with malignancy. But the biopsy was actually pretty interesting. Now, in this case, why did they go ahead and do a biopsy? They weren't concerned about germ cell tumor. So biopsy revealed, take a look here. What are those things around the organisms? There's our sulfur stain. Is anything budding? Anyway, so we've got candida, E. coli is option A, candida, option B, E. coli, option C, cryptococcus, option D, aspergillus, option E, nocardia. All right, yes, we are looking at cryptococcus. We have granulomas, so the pathologist told me, with round organisms that are clearly yeast on the silver stain and have visible capsules. And I put this case in just to remind you that all sorts of interesting things get into the prostate, and you are the ID doctor, and you will be called to discuss those. All right, moving on, we're going to talk about now the testicle itself. So we're talking about now orchitis, involvement of the testicle, not the prostate, not the epididymis. 35-year-old man who's a member of a religious group that does not support vaccination and went to a wedding in Nebraska. 2 days later, he has pain in his left ear and he has jaw tenderness. 11 days later, he has noticeable swelling under both sides of his jaw. He has fever and painful swelling of the left testicle. The most likely causative agent is A, mumps, B, measles, C, E. coli, or D, Neisseria gonorrhea. Yes, we're going to get mumps here. So with parotid swelling and orchitis, you know, this is an older, it's kind of a classic picture. Unfortunately, we're now seeing so much more mumps because of lack of vaccination. I could probably get an updated picture. Measles is not a common cause of orchitis. E. coli, gonorrhea, both could cause orchitis, but it's unlikely that they would also be associated with the swelling under the jaw. Orchitis, which is isolated involvement of the testes, is often a viral infection. Like this whole talk I've been talking about bacterial things and fungal things, I want you to shift your thinking with viral infection. Mumps is a common cause of orchitis and Coxsackie B virus. And then apparently lymphocytic chorioamenangitis can also cause infection there. You can get bacterial orchitis with contiguous spread from the epididymis, which we already talked about. And the same organisms that cause epididymitis, if you don't catch it early enough, can end up causing also orchitis, such as E. coli, but also TB, as we discussed, and fungal organisms. I thought this was one of the more effective vaccine campaigns, so I included the photo here, and it's talking about the swelling's not so bad. It's the severe testicular pain. And it talks. It was used in college campuses to recommend people get vaccinated with the MMR vaccine. So a little entertainment for y'all. So mumps in the United States, this was data that I had in 2025. But the bottom line has been rising since 2006, often outbreaks in communities with close contact. No reported cases doesn't necessarily mean there weren't any, it just means none were reported. The vaccine is effective and PCR testing is more reliable than doing antibody testing. Okay, so to wrap things up, we talked about epididymitis. You should think in your mind, is this a sexually transmitted infection versus E. coli and other enteric flora? We talked about prostatitis, and I want you to consider that a man with a febrile UTI could have acute bacterial prostatitis instead of pyelonephritis. And you would detect that based on a physical exam and also imaging findings and the presence of the pelvic or perineal pain. You want to consider chronic bacterial prostatitis in men with recurrent or relapsing UTI, and the two last tests could help you out there. Fungal, TB, and all sorts of indolent organisms can invade, infect, hang out in the male genital urinary tract. So these should be on your differential. And then isolated orchitis without involvement of the epididymis or the prostate is rare in adults. So you want to consider a viral etiology such as mumps or Coxsackie. So hopefully that answers all your questions. I've put my email address on here and I look forward to meeting some of you in the in-person course.